wondering if I could make an announcement about the meeting on Monday.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excuse me, could I ask for a volunteer to get some batteries for the radio mic here? Does anybody know the janitor's room as you come into the building? So we're going to be without a... Thanks very much.
No, I can be very loud, very easy.
Can you ask me after?
Absolutely.
Yes.
No, at all. No, you can use. I think that one's still working.
Hi, everybody. I'm Marcus Norton, and I'm one of the class reps you have for this year. And there's a class rep meeting on Monday.
These batteries are dead.
Yeah, and we'd like to know if you have any complaints about this course or any other courses. Please tell us. Or Thea across there, who you all know. She just waved her hand if you saw her. And yeah. So you come to us today, hopefully. Not after 11 o'clock at night. I won't answer your phone calls. Not on Sunday. I like to sleep. But the meeting's on Monday, so you have to be really quick. So yeah. Thanks.
All right, sorry for the... Do we have sound?
Yeah.
Good. All right, yes, sorry for the delay in getting started. All right, so I'm going to try and do two things today. Firstly, get through some slides on virtual memory, so kind of finish our discussion about memory. Also, if I've got time at the end, what I'll do is I'll give you a very quick intro to using the to a lab which kind of introduces you to the second coursework. So, apologies, second coursework is not quite out yet. I've got the lab up on the web pages, which you should have seen from the email earlier today. So you can get started on that, and hopefully tonight I'll have the coursework itself out for you. We'll see if we get to that. If not, I'll do it next week. All right. So, yeah, we're going to talk about virtual memory. Talk about what it is, why we want it, and kind of go through some of the details inside it. So, let's get on with motivation. Why do we need virtual memory? So, the kind of historically, people came up with this concept to address two main problems. The first is, how do we move the burden of programmers having to deal with limited main memory? And what do we mean by this? Kind of two related issues. So firstly, we want to run a system maybe with many users, but certainly with many programs running simultaneously. Each of them has some kind of memory footprint, and maybe if we add up all the memory footprints of the different programs, they add up to more than the available physical memory in our system. What do we do? How do we bring in the different programs when we want to run them? And how do we manage that? And do we run into issues where, say, we want multiple programs in memory at once, and therefore we have to kind of shift programs around so they don't overlap with each other in the memory? And when we do that shifting, do we have to do what we call relocation? Do we have to mess with some of the absolute addresses in those programs so that they run correctly when we've shifted where we've actually placed them in memory? So that's kind of one issue that virtual memory helps to address. Another one has to do with safety and protection. How do we allow efficient and safe sharing of memory among multiple programs? So here, kind of several concerns. For example, we don't want it that arbitrary user programs can write over critical data or even access some critical data within the operating system, which is managing processes and managing the computing resources. And also, you don't want different user programs interfering with each other. If one user program crashes, you don't want that to bring down the whole system. And also, you don't want one user's program to be able to access data of another user on that same system, on that same computer. So there's these kind of two concerns, actually, both of which virtual memory addresses. Initially, very much it was the first question that it was addressing primarily. But over time, actually, I'd say now it's probably more the second one, which is the more important issue it's addressing, although it's still certainly addressing the first one too, and we'll talk about how it does address the first one. All right, so the basic idea of virtual memory is that we have a virtual address space, as shown here. Say here it's 64 kilobytes, 2 to 32 bytes. And this is what the programmer sees. When you're programming, you see a 32-bit or maybe even higher number of bits address space. However, it might be that your hardware actually doesn't have that much memory, doesn't fill up every single byte of that 4 gigabytes, but only fills up some subsets, say only 2 to the 24 bytes. And this is unrealistically small, but it will serve for the sake of argument. So what happens is, say, our program is using, we divide our address space up into blocks. And it will be the case that most of the time, say, when we look at, say, blocks A, B, or C, that we will have placed copies of those blocks. So this is what the programmer sees. And what will happen is, behind the scenes, those blocks will be located in our physical memory here. On occasion, though, what will happen is that we're going to want to access some block of memory, often called a page, which isn't currently in this physical memory here. And in that case, a special part of the operating system called the virtual memory manager comes into play, and it looks on a disk in a special area called swap space where these extra blocks are held for these missing blocks. And then when we want to access D, it looks over here, we'll bring it into the physical memory, and then from then on we can access it in the physical memory. So that's the kind of basic idea of what will be happening, is that the programmer will see addresses in this virtual address space, but behind the scenes, a combination of the hardware and operating system will be translating those addresses, those virtual addresses, into physical addresses, and also as needed into calls to disk I/O routines to fetch data from the disk into physical memory, and actually vice versa too. Once this physical memory gets very full, it'll be necessary to transfer blocks from the physical memory out to disk as well. All right, so this is kind of saying in words some of the things I was saying as well. I think I've said actually everything there. So I mean, the main thing here is that the virtual address space is the space that you, the programmer, see, and that the CPU itself is seeing, or thinks that has access to. I guess here, down here, the one piece of extra information is the hardware that's involved in managing memory is not surprisingly called the memory management unit. Sometimes that's just abbreviated to MMU. All right. So, in general, this virtual memory could be larger than physical memory. Usually, we view the disk memory that kind of sits to the side of the physical memory as another level in our memory hierarchy, like we were discussing earlier in the week. And to some extent, we want the same kind of reasoning to apply, that we'd like some transparency from the programmer point of view to accesses which actually miss or have misses when accessing the main memory and result in fetching data from the disk. So I think, again, I was saying before when looking at the picture, I was saying much of this stuff. We have physical memory kind of holds what you're working on right now, so it acts like a bit like a cache for the whole disk or for the swap space on disk. We've got the swap space area, which holds the full memory space for each process. The operating system's taking care of moving data between the swap space and the physical memory as needed. And critically, from the programmer's point of view, this movement of data in and out is going to be transparent. Bit of terminology, so I talked about these blocks of memory being shifted back and forth. So especially when you're dealing with something like a disk, you don't want to be fetching just a few bytes at a time from a disk, because the disk is so large, it's got so long, such large access times. And as we saw earlier, we're dealing with 10, 20 milliseconds. If you're going to disk to fetch some data, you should be fetching a decent amount of data at once. So typically, these blocks that you deal with range in sizes between about 1 and 64 kilobytes. We call these blocks often pages rather than blocks, so that the concept is basically the same. And we talk about, say, virtual pages in the virtual memory and physical pages in the physical memory. Interestingly, let's just talk over this remark. Yes, we don't want these block sizes to be too small, because then it means we've got to make a lot of requests to disk, and everything kind of slows down. But if we make these things too large, then maybe we're just bringing in too much data, most of which we never need to use. So there's a bit of a trade-off there.
But having large blocks, it makes for more generally in this kind of range, it makes for more efficient disk use. And also, as we'll see, there are these tables which allow you to translate virtual addresses to physical addresses. And the bigger the block, the smaller these tables need to be. So these tables for doing the translation go by the name of page tables. We'll see how they work in a second. But what's really interesting is that the decision was made that each process will have its own page table. So its own mapping of virtual memory addresses to physical memory addresses. And this really, it may seem like a bit of a kind of wasteful decision to start off with, but it really then gives the kind of the system architect tremendous freedom. Because then what it allows is that different processes can use the same virtual addresses. So to a large extent, each process can behave as if it's the sole owner of that whole 32 or 64-bit address space. It can act as if nobody else is using that address space at all, and it can just have great freedom about how it, where it puts itself, where the program text goes, and where the data text goes, and so on. Each process doesn't have to worry about fitting around where some other process is going to be loaded into virtual memory. So this really simplifies process management. Also, too, what one can then do with the page table is make it so that each process only has access to a subset of the whole virtual memory space. And you can say, look, you can have access to these pages in the virtual memory space, but not these other pages. And so this can be of great help in stopping your program accessing kind of memory spaces that it shouldn't access. So hopefully in tutorials by now, you've kind of been talking a bit about dynamic memory management and pointers and the dangers of inadvertently trying to access addresses which really haven't been allocated to your program. So with a virtual memory system and a page table, you can set things up so that when a user tries to access some page which their program really hasn't been allocated, then you can actually have hardware which steps in to recognize that fact and stop the program. And so, for example, too, when you ever do a null pointer dereference as well, almost invariably a null pointer is to a page which is, in some sense, protected. You can never actually access data from where a null pointer points. And so in that way, too, the system can catch cases when you try to access data, try to dereference, look at the data that's stored at the address in a null pointer. So this per process page table is a very useful thing to have. All right, so here we're going to go through now how these page tables work. What have we got? So on the right here, we have, say, for example, a 32-bit address, a virtual address. It's comprised of two parts, what we'll call a page number, which says which page we're trying to address, and then a page offset, which says which byte within the page we're trying to address. So for example, if we've got 10 bits in the page offset, that means each of our pages is 1 kilobyte in size. And so we're going to start with virtual addresses, and with the page table, what we're aiming to do is say which, if any, physical address each virtual page corresponds to. So we're going to take these addresses and essentially translate them into shorter addresses, which then will be real addresses into the real physical memory. All right, so here's how we do it. So we have in main memory, we have a table called the page table. The kind of simplest view of how things work. In practice, the story is more complicated, but for the point of view of this course, this is the story I'm going to tell, and this is the story you kind of need to know because it's the first good approximation to what's going, what actually is going on. So I've got this page table in memory. It's just an array of data structures. And so what happens is we have a page table base address. This is just the start address of this array here. And we add to the start address the page number appropriate scale to give us the, so if this is, say, is page number P, then we want to go to the pth entry in this table here. And in that pth table, we first of all got a physical page number or frame number, and we can use that number which is stored there to compose with the page offset to form a physical address. So there's an entry, so this is the table, since it's been addressed by these page numbers, there's one entry in this table for every single page. As you can see, so here we've got 22 bits, we've got 4 million pages. So this page is this page table is a decent size. If you go to kind of architectures with more than 32 bits, so say with the current 64-bit architectures, the addresses that actually handle or the addresses that are handled are typically between 44 and 48 bits long. Typically, you wouldn't want to set up a page table with a single entry for every 44-bit address, or 48, or every 44, every, I guess it would reduce a bit, but we get, say, a 34 or 38-bit page number, which still is giving us an awful lot of pages. So we do something clever there, but we won't be dealing with that here. So the idea is, anyway, this table has got one row for every page. And what it does is it tells us actually several things. It tells us, firstly, if a physical page exists at all for that virtual page. So of course, since we've got many more virtual pages than physical pages, we can only have physical pages for a small subset of virtual pages. It's first of all telling us, indeed, if there is at all a physical page for each virtual page. And it does that using one of these status bits. And then if there is one, then the frame number or physical page number tells us which physical page to go to for that data. And typically we put these kind of tables go into part of the main memory that's reserved for the operating system. So normal your normal user programs can't access this page directly. Indeed, it would be a kind of security violation if it did, because the whole point is that this table is also going to be used for managing which virtual pages, which physical pages, which physical pages a process can address, but also manages which accesses to virtual pages are valid and which ones will cause a trap and cause an exception to be raised. So not exception to be, I shouldn't use software terminology, it will cause an exception, full stop. All right, so let's talk a bit about moving pages between our backup storage, usually magnetic disk, and this main memory. So if our virtual address turns out not to have a mapping in the page table to some physical address, then we get what's called a page fault. So this is like a cache miss, but we use, historically for virtual memory, we use slightly different terminology. So page fault is when we look in the page table, we find that there's no physical page corresponding to the virtual page that we want to access. So we invoke the operating system through the interrupt mechanism. There'll be some hardware sometimes that does this, that helps there. The particular bit in the page table that tells us whether a virtual page is in use often goes by the name of the residence bit. So typically we start off with physical memory. I mean, if a system started from scratch, the physical memory would be empty, data might be out on disk, and as we demand data, we'll get page faults, and that data will be loaded in from the disk into the physical memory. When, if we reach a situation where the whole of physical memory is occupied, every physical page is in use, then we've got to start replacing current pages. And there are kind of various issues, kind of questions about how we do this. So for example, if you remember, what one of the key things that we rely on with caches and with virtual memory too, is this concept of temporal locality. So if we've accessed data recently, it's likely that we're going to be accessing it again, or at least something close to it. So if we want to choose some data to throw out of the cache, we probably want to throw out data that's been accessed less recently. One way of doing this is to have a very one crude way, but still that works and is used, is to just have a bit on a, for every page. And periodically, we set these bits whenever a process accesses a page. There's one of these access bits per page. We set an access bit when we access a page, and just periodically we walk through the whole page table resetting all the access bits. And so this means that if we just scan through the page table and we look for pages with an access bit set to zero, then by and large, on average, usually that those pages are going to be the older pages. Those are going to be the pages we haven't recently accessed. So it's quite a very crude mechanism, but still it gives us some measure of age of pages. So, so that's kind of one way in which we can measure whether a page has been recently accessed or not. And also, too, we do something similar to what happens with caches when we have these dirty bits telling us whether we've written to, in the case of caches, to a given block, in the case of virtual memory, whether we've written to a given physical page. Because if, say, we've loaded a physical page from the disk, and we've only ever read data from that physical page, when we want to swap that physical page out, we don't actually have to write it back to disk at all, because still the copy in disk is the same as the copy that's in main memory. However, if we have modified that physical page, then we should copy it back to disk when we replace that physical page by some new one that's coming in. How much is this making sense? Anybody want to ask any questions at this stage? All right, let's continue. All right, so what we're going to see here is we're going to walk through an example of two page replacement policies, both of which are kind of based on age, but they work in slightly different ways. These are schemes which will be more sophisticated than just using single access bits. One's called the FIFO scheme, first in, first out. The idea here is that we kick pages out of the physical memory in the same order that they came in. And the other one we'll consider as the LRU, least recently used one. So we'll kind of look at how recently we accessed all the pages, and we'll throw out the page that we accessed the furthest in the past. So let's consider a very simple case. Say we've got physical memory just with four pages, and we've got some virtual page references here. So these are all page numbers, and say page numbers go between 0 and 16 or something, or 0 and 15. And we've got this sequence of virtual page accesses, 0, 2, 6, 0, 7, 8. So let's see in each case what happens. So initially, we assume that the physical pages are all empty in both cases. We'll do this case first, the least recently used case. So we've got access 0, that's a page fault, and we fetch page 0 in from the swap space on disk. Got access 2, that's a page fault as well. Again, we fetch the data in from the swap space on disk. access to 6 is a page fault. We fetch a new page in from disk. Now we come to a second access to virtual page 0. Now we've already loaded that page into the physical memory. It's here. So when we do 0, we get a hit. And we're showing that by yellow here. Now we come to access 7. We still have one more slot left in our memory, in our physical memory, so 7 is just going to slip into that physical slot there. And now we come to access 8. Now this is the interesting case, because now all our 4 physical pages are occupied, and now we're making a request to a virtual page for which we're making a request to a virtual page which isn't any of these physical pages here. There's no physical page corresponding to virtual page 8. So now we've got to decide to throw out one of those physical pages to make room to bring in virtual page number 8. And so let's see. So if we're doing a least recently used policy, which of these 4 pages is least recently used? So who would say 0? Page 0 is least recently used. Anybody? How about page 2? Sounds good. How about page 6? Or page 7? Well, for all of you who chose page 2, you give yourself a pat on the back. Indeed, page 2 is the right answer. And so the point is, yes, that of page 2, 0, 2, 6, 0, and 7, 2 is the least recently accessed one. So that's why we put the 8 in there. However, in the FIFO situation, things go as before in a similar pattern. We load the 7. But now with the FIFO, which page are we going to throw out? Is it going to be page 0? Show of hands. Is it going to be page, how about page 2? Page 6? Any bids? Page 7? So yes, it seems like you're getting an idea. So page 0 indeed is the page we would throw out, because that was the first of the 4, we've got 4 pages loaded here, and it's the oldest one. If we go back to the time we loaded it, it's one with the earliest load time into the FIFO. All right, so it seems like you've got these key ideas of these 2 page replacement policies. Let's move on. So accessing this page table is a costly thing to do. So remember, it's kind of out there in memory. Maybe you've got some caching schemes, so we're actually accessing the page table from a cache. But still, we're kind of incurring an extra penalty in every single memory access, every single memory read or memory write. Up till this lecture, we've just been saying, well, with a memory read or write, it finishes fairly quickly. You just kind of send out an address, and you get back the data. Now we're talking about possibly 2 memory accesses for each load and each store. Firstly, you've got to go out to the page table to find out where your physical page is. And then once you've found your physical page, you can actually go fetch your data, or you can write your data. So we've doubled the kind of latency of memory, the time it takes to do a read or a write. This is not good. And so people design an extra piece of hardware. Essentially, it's a cache for the page table, a very fast cache for the page table. And this memory goes by the name of a translation look-aside buffer. And this is a cache which is contained within this memory management unit hardware. So as it says in the text here, so it's a small fast table located close to the processor. It's a cache for the page table. Unlike these other caches we looked at, which are caches for data, This is a cache for address information. Typically, whereas we have distinct page tables for each process, since we're using a hardware resource here, it would be rather expensive to have a separate piece of hardware for each process. So we have instead one TLB for all the processes. And this means when we do a process switch, we have to make sure that we invalidate all the contents of this cache when we do the switch. This invalidation is very important. Can anybody think why? There's something I said a couple of slides back that makes this invalidation absolutely crucial. Any clues? Second program doesn't use data from the first program, yes. So, with these page tables are per process, each process has got this almost virgin view of memory. And so it's quite possible that you'll have two separate processes which will be accessing the same virtual address, be using the same virtual address, but for different purposes. And so if you didn't invalidate the TLB, then one process could start accessing data or program of the other process quite inadvertently. So you really want to clear this cache completely when you switch over to the new process. So just like the data caches, though, so this is a cache for this page table translation from virtual pages to physical pages. So when we look in this cache and we find something's not there, we have to go out to the page table in memory and fetch the new data in. And just as with any other kind of cache, we've also got this issue of sometimes the cache gets full and we have to throw out old entries to make space for new entries. Here's a kind of one picture of a TLB cache. So they can be fully associative caches. So what's happening is when we come in with a physical address, we might search every single location for some row, search every single row for one which has got a page number which matches the virtual page number coming in. And then when we find that match, we've got the corresponding frame number or physical page number, which we can use then to compose, to build the physical address. But typically, these caches can be quite small, especially if they're fully associative, say between 16 and 512 entries. And just a final remark, sometimes we don't use a fully associative memory, but use what's called a set associative memory, which means that when we've got a given virtual address, virtual page number here, and we're searching for some match with a page number here, we don't search the whole cache, the whole TLB, but we just search 4 entries or 16 entries of it. All right, so that's virtual memory. Any questions on that? This is just kind of a very high-level overview. There are notes linked to from the online web pages, and certainly have a read of the chapters, the sections of the book that I point you to on the course webpage. So is all this reasonably straightforward? All right, I've got a couple of minutes left. What I'd like to do is to see if I can show you a tiny bit about lab. Okay. Let's see, how's this going to work? Okay, let's see how this works. Do we have anything? Yes, we do. All right. Great. So nothing's quite looking like anything else. So we've got three different portions of a screen. So this you should be familiar with. So that's just the course schedule page. And scroll down. At the bottom, there's this lab on System C Basics. So the second coursework is all about designing the control unit of a processor and doing that design using a little bit of C coding. So here, there's this lab, which is an intro to running simulations using what's called the System C modeling and simulation language. So the page here tells you all about. Everything's got rather. Let's see. This lab tells you all about using it. Just get rid of this one. So in System C, so it's C++. Don't worry, you don't have to know C++, but it's an object-oriented extension of C. And using it, you can describe hardware. So, for example, I've got all my scales completely wrong here. Let's try this. Yes, we can do something. This is a C file, so C++ file, using the System C library. It's a description, in this case, of an adder built from full adder components. You don't really have to. I'm just kind of showing you this to give you an idea that System C is describing hardware in some sense. So you're declaring signals in C++, which correspond to the hardware signals. So there's some signals declared up here. Here we're instantiating some hardware, declaring some hardware components. So saying we've got a class type called FA for full adder, and here we're we're wiring up the full adder. We're saying, actually for several full adders, what inputs they take. This file is essentially describing the structure of an adder. And then, let's get rid of that. Let's see if, so what you'll do is you'll there's a tar file which you unpack, and you'll go down into directories containing, for example, here we've got the System C code, which describes a simple ripple carry adder, it's called. And we type make to compile it. How many of you have come across make so far? Some of you. How many of you haven't? All right, some of you as well. So make is an extremely useful Unix utility for helping you to go through the process of compiling programs. It allows you to do something to kind of set lots of parameters and set things up so that you just have to type words like make with no arguments, and it just kind of goes away and it reads data in this file called makefile, which is up there somewhere. Here, so there's data in this makefile which kind of gives all the instructions on what to do. So that one typing of make actually invoked, caused the invocation of the G++ GNU C++ compiler several times with all kinds of arguments here. And I didn't have to retype those arguments each time. They're all kind of enshrined in that makefile program. So it makes a very useful utility. At some stage, it's not quite that you learn about it, but you might well want to find out more about it. And there's plenty of online documentation. All right, so here I've compiled the C++ program, say, for a 3 or 4 bit Ripple carry adder. You'll do this too if you just follow the lab instructions. If we kind of look at what we've got now, we've got a few more things. We've got this thing called RCA, which is an executable. So that's the result of the compilation of the system C code. And now if we execute it, we'll run the system C simulation. Scroll down here a bit. We're there. So the simulation's run. And then what you'll do is you'll invoke a waveform viewer. So there's a waveform viewer called GTK. I can't see this at all. There we go. GTK wave. And there's a file called waves.vcd. So this is all explained in the instructions. So I'm just kind of showing you what goes on to kind of get you into doing the lab. And this will open up waveform viewer. And so what happens is you select a bunch of signals, so one input to this device. These are A0 to A3 and so on are inputs to this adder device. So you can do things like you can select a range of signals like A0 to A3, and you can ask, well, how do these signals change over time in a simulation? And that's what we see on the right here. We see time along the top there, and we've got each of these signals, A0, 1, A2, A3, and we see over time how they're switching values. And in the lab, you can pull up so this is just one set of inputs. You can call up other sets of inputs too, and you can just explore how this waveform viewer works, because you'll be using this for the course. So in this lab, you're just looking at some kind of canned hardware examples. But later on, when you come to the coursework itself, you'll be looking at simulation of a simple MIPS-like processor design, and you'll be tweaking the control unit of that to get it to execute properly a few instructions that I'll tell you about and give you specifications for. Right now you can already get started on looking at this GTK wave thing, and for example, exploring features like, if you want to, you can do cool things like take a bunch of signals. Let's say take all of these, and you can hit a certain function key like F5, and it bundles all those signals up into a single bit vector. So let's say this one up here, and now we see the value of all these bits here considered as a 4-bit word rather than just as individual binary words. And so we see it has value 1 there, and now when the two lower bits are high, you can probably just about read it's got value 3. Anyway, so I encourage you to kind of get started on this lab as soon as possible as a gentle introduction to what the coursework will be about. And as I said, this coursework itself will be out imminently, so I'm hoping tonight, if not then, certainly very soon this weekend. All right, any basic questions?